From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor James Belushi. He's starring in the new ABC miniseries, Wild Palms. It's a futuristic techno-thriller. Belushi plays a TV executive caught up in the computer-generated world of illusion that his network broadcasts. Also today, a modern-day search for a lost gospel. We talk with Wilton Barnhart about his new novel, Gospel. This 800-page saga takes a satirical but studious look at religion. And world music critic Milo Miles reviews the debut album by the women's a cappella group Zap Mama. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Muslim and Croat military commanders in southern Bosnia have signed a ceasefire, but it's still not clear whether the truce has taken effect in the southern city of Mostar. The Muslim-controlled Bosnian radio said there was hand-to-hand fighting in the streets hours after the ceasefire was scheduled to go into effect. Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic appealed to the United Nations Security Council to declare the city a UN-protected safe zone. The local Croatian Army Command says the ceasefire provides for freedom of movement for all UN forces, international relief groups, and reporters. The French foreign minister denied today that there's a split between the United States and Europe over policy in Bosnia. He said France could not rule out military action in Bosnia, but wants to avoid it. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Foreign Minister Alain Juppé told Parliament today that France continues to favor political and diplomatic solutions to the civil war in Bosnia. He said tougher sanctions against Serbia are working. He said the military way is the way of despair. We don't have the right to rule it out, he said, but at the same time, we have the duty to do everything possible to avoid it. Juppé insisted that France is still eager to coordinate with Washington. The U.S. wants to lift the arms embargo against the Bosnian Muslims and bomb selected Serbian targets. But Juppé said the lifting of the arms embargo and airstrikes would result in a halt to aid work in Bosnia, adding that if military action were taken, France would have to pull its 5,000 troops out of the area. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Military brass from all branches of the service told a House Defense Subcommittee today they see few obstacles in implementing Secretary of Defense Les Aspin's order to allow women to fly combat aircraft. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
The Army has already started training female combat pilots, and the Navy, Marines, and Air Force are gearing up to begin. Deputy Chief of Naval Operations Ronald Zalatiper told the subcommittee members that combat pilots will be accepted on a gender-neutral basis. There will be no quotas. Zalatiper said he believes any problems the male pilots may have integrating women into combat roles will be eased through experience.
My belief is the biggest problem is that not every man in the Navy has had an opportunity to serve with women aviators, as have I. Education and training can help, but actually serving with women is the best way to erase stereotypes and prejudices.
Secretary Aspin has also asked Congress to drop a legal ban against women serving on combat ships. Zalatiper told the committee that if the law is changed, the Navy aims to make up to one-fifth of its warship crews women by the end of 1997. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
The Dow closed at a record 3,482 today. This is NPR. UN helicopters evacuated the first casualties from the besieged Muslim enclave of Jeppa today. French helicopters picked up about 40 people, but the evacuation organizers said it appeared that those in the most urgent need of medical attention still haven't been taken out. A French radio operator said there'd been difficulty getting the most seriously injured people to the airstrip for evacuation. Pro- and anti-whaling nations continue to confront each other at a meeting of the International Whaling Commission in Kyoto, Japan. Norway and Japan are thought to have little chance to win key votes on plans to resume commercial whaling. But a French plan to create an Antarctic whaling sanctuary also appears to be doomed. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
The 45th meeting of the Whaling Commission has been one of its most contentious, mostly because Japan and Norway are pressing to resume a limited commercial hunt of non-endangered minke whales. This week, after it became clear that the whaling proposals would not win, the government of Norway complained that environmental groups were unfairly influencing the proceedings. Confrontations between whalers and environmentalists were reported outside the convention center. On the other hand, a French proposal to create a whaling sanctuary in Antarctic waters is also expected to fall short of the 75% yes vote it needs. Environmentalists had praised the sanctuary plan, claiming that it would help preserve the breeding grounds of many whales. Whaling nations said there was no proof that the creation of an Antarctic sanctuary would do anything for whale populations. Formal voting begins tomorrow. I'm John Nielsen in Washington.
A Texas medical examiner says that 22 of the sect members who died in the fire at the Branch Davidian compound last month had gunshot wounds, some of which were self-inflicted. Medical examiner Nizam Pirwani said that autopsies have now been performed on a total of 78 bodies removed from the compound. This is NPR News.
If you enjoy offbeat television, you'll probably be seeing a lot of my guest James Belushi next week. He stars in ABC's new futuristic cyber thriller, Wild Palms. It's a miniseries set in the entertainment industry in the year 2007. Belushi plays a TV executive whose nightmarish hallucinations are really computer-generated illusions called virtual reality. Belushi started his career at Second City in Chicago, the improvisational comedy group that also launched the career of his late brother John Belushi. James also followed his brother as a regular performer on Saturday Night Live. James Belushi's films include Salvador, About Last Night, Canine, Thief, Red Heat, The Principal, and Traces of Red. I asked him to describe the look and the mood of his character in Wild Palms.
My character's name is Harry Wyckoff. He's a patent attorney. For my character, the story is about a man's awakening from one nightmare to another. Some men become enlightened, and some men are dragged to enlightenment. And that's the story about Harry Wyckoff here. He is dragged to become an enlightened man. And he's very passive at the beginning, and he turns into samurai warrior by the end. He becomes a man that takes care of his family and reaches to community.
In some ways, at least the parts that I've seen, the opening episodes of Wild Palms, it's kind of like high-tech noir, like high-tech film noir.
Yeah, I describe it as television noir.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very dark, it's black, it's very edgy. There's a paranoia that runs through it. As in all of Oliver's pieces, there's this edge, this fear, and this carries in Wild Palms on a television show. That's why I'm blown away by Bob Iger and ABC for putting this on. It's like something you've never seen on television.
It seems to me this is a different direction for you. In Traces of Red, also, it was another noir kind of film, and you were the lead in that. I mean, you started off in comedy, then got into some action roles.
Well, there's a misconception about what I started off in.
Mm-hmm.
I've been acting since a sophomore in high school, and I've done every type of entertainment you can think of. I've done drama. I won a state award in college for a drama piece that I did. I've done musicals. I was in a movie Thief, Salvador, Palermo Connection, Homer and Eddie. Those are all dramatic roles. But what I'm known for mainly is comedy, because the most successful films were comedies like K-9 or About Last Night or even Saturday Night Live. But I've always done everything.
James Belushi is my guest, and he stars in the new series Wild Palms, a kind of a high-tech thriller that begins this Sunday on ABC. Can we go back to your childhood for a little while here?
You want to go back to
my childhood?
Doctor, it's blocked.
That's right.
I'm living in denial about my childhood.
Onto that couch, James.
Please. Are you going to hypnotize me? Bring me back. Bring me back. I only remember a few things about my childhood.
Mm-hmm. Well, just watch my watch.
Okay.
Now, you grew up in Chicago.
Yes.
Your father was from Albania?
Yes.
Your mother, too?
No, my mother's from Akron, Ohio. But her parents are from Albania.
Now, your father ran a restaurant?
Yes, a few restaurants.
What kinds?
My father started out as a dishwasher. Then he went to valet, parking cars, and then he was a waiter and a bartender and a manager. And then him and my uncle Paul started a place on Logan Square in Chicago, which is one of the cheeseburger place.
Oh, right.
Which
right,
is really
right.
Where my brother John got that character. It was mm-hmm. based on my Uncle Paul. It was a combination of my Uncle Paul and my dad. When he talked, when the character talked, that was my Uncle Paul. When he sighed and breathed and looked tough, he was doing my dad. Because my dad didn't talk much. So he started off that way and built his way up into when I started working for him. He had a beautiful steakhouse, two steakhouses in Chicago.
Fancy?
Very nice, very fancy. Lobster steaks and red walls and white tablecloths, and I did everything there.
Oh, so you had to work in it.
Oh, yeah. If you didn't lose the restaurant, I'd be serving lunch today, believe me.
So you had a bus and waiter and all that?
Well, the first thing he did is, you know, my dad wasn't around much, and he didn't talk much, and I wanted a relationship with him. And so I demanded for him to take me to work with him. I was 11. And so he took me, and the first day he put me in the basement, which was the scariest place. It was dark. It was a little wet. There was nobody down there. It was an old building. And he made me clean the floors.
Oh, boy.
He made me scrape the Coca-Cola syrupy stuff off this bottle return. He made me redo the stock room. He made me inventory. He made me pick up all the little fat that they trimmed from the meat. He wanted to scare me. He wanted me to go, I don't want to do this anymore. I did it. I cleaned that basement. There was nothing else to clean. So then he finally brought me upstairs to dishwasher.
Oh, were there a lot of cockroaches and vermin down there?
I was scared to death. I was 11 years old. I was every noise I heard, my heart would beat, you know. He tried to scare me, but I passed the test, and I eventually made it up to the broiler cook. I cooked steaks, fish, lobster. I did pantry. I learned a lot of things. I learned how to make wild cucumber salad and string bean salad and coleslaw and beets. And I can do all that stuff. Terry, I can cook for you, Terry.
Is this an offer?
This is an offer. We'll have to meet between here and Philadelphia.
All right. So, you know, in most families, dinner is supposed to be like the big family time, but your father was probably always out at the restaurant around dinner time.
Oh, man, I remember my dad. We wouldn't know when he was coming home, and we'd sit at the table, and all the food would be out. And the thing with my dad was, this was his thing. He wanted to sit at the table and eat with the family. And we'd have to wait and wait and wait, and we'd be cranky and crying and hungry. And so my mom would say, well, eat something, right? And we'd start eating a little something, and then we could see the headlights come across the curtains coming up the driveway. And it was like we cleaned the plates, put everything back, and sat like good little boys and girls. You know, it was tense. And then he'd come. He'd come in the house. He'd go into the bedroom. He might take a nap, and we'd sit at that table. Then he'd come, and we'd eat, and he wouldn't say a word. So what was the big deal? Why he wanted to be around, you know? I don't know.
The mysteries of families.
Yeah, it was fun.
James Belushi is my guest, and he's starring in the new ABC high-tech thriller series, Wild Palms, and it premieres on Sunday. Now, what about television and movies when you were growing up? Was the TV always on in the house? Did you
always.
Go to movies all the time?
Always.
Mm-hmm. What were your favorites, TV shows, when you were growing up?
When I was growing up?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gee, all of them. Gilligan's Island, and I always liked watching... The big influential one in our house was The Honeymooners. Reruns, you know. I don't even know. God, you're really taking me back here, Terry.
Hey.
What were the big ones? I don't know. We were Johnny Carson. I grew up with Johnny Carson. That's to this date, I don't fall asleep till 1:30 in the morning because as a child, I watched Carson.
Did you have to sneak that in?
Yes.
Would your parents let you stay up that late?
They were asleep.
Uh-huh.
Once they went to sleep, I owned the house.
So would you sneak back out into the living room, put on the TV?
Oh, I used to sneak out in the living room, put on the TV. I used to eat. I used to drive the car.
Oh, no, really?
Oh, yeah, I stole the car. I used to steal all the time. They'd be asleep. I'd take the keys, go, pick up friends. You know, I'm 13, 14, driving around. I used to sit on telephone books and drive at 2 in the morning, you know.
Did your father ever find out?
Yes, one time I stole the car, it was freezing rain, so it was ice out,
That's the worst.
Yeah, and I picked up my friends, and we went over to this house where there was a slumber party of these girls. And I parked the car in the street, and we ran over and spied on them. The cops came to the car. And like an idiot, I told them it was my car. And they said, where's your license? I said, I don't have a license. So they arrested me. Instead, I could have went home, snuck into bed, and said, hey, Dad, someone stole the car. I don't know. You know. So I got busted for driving without a license, and the rest is history.
What did your father have to say?
I told him. My dad didn't talk much.
Did he hit you?
No. No, my father never touched me.
What did your mother say?
I can't remember that. I think she made me a steak. I think what happened is when I got in trouble, they felt it was their fault, and so she fed me, you know. That's why now when I get in trouble, I go out and have a steak. I remember on Saturday Night Live, I used to get in trouble with Dick Ebersole.
Yeah, the producer.
The producer, and I went down to Hurley's, and it would eat a steak, and I think it had something to do with my mom. I don't know.
Yeah, when people talk about comfort food, they don't usually mean a big sirloin.
Oh, yeah, no, it was definitely a comfort food.
Now, what about movies? Did you go to movies a lot?
Yeah. Sure, I went to the matinees all the time. I remember seeing X-15 a bunch of times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I always went to the movies.
Did you do impressions of your favorite actors?
No, I was not the mimic in the family.
That was John?
John could imitate anything and everything. He was a master technician at imitation. I still can't imitate anything. He would imitate the family. He'd do great imitations of my dad, except for when my dad came home. You know, he wouldn't do it. But
when did you become interested in acting?
Professionally or just when I started?
No. I think you said you started acting in high school.
Well, I went. I had a speech class.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the date. It was October 15th, because that was the day of the first Vietnam moratorium.
Mm-hmm.
And no, it was actually on the 16th. And I had to have a speech, and I wasn't prepared. And so what I did is I put on an armband and some beads, and I busted into the classroom and gave kind of a yippie speech. And I screamed at the class for not supporting the moratorium. And they got really aggravated with me because they knew I wasn't there because I was in school the day before. And they're like yelling back at me, and I'm screaming at them. I just improvised. And the teacher happened to be the drama teacher also. I got a D on the speech because of the organization. But he made me audition for his play that night and gave me the starring role in the play.
That's a great story.
Yeah, yeah. But he couldn't give me an A on performance on the speech.
Do you remember what you said in that speech that you made?
Yeah, just like, where were you guys? We have to support this, man. Hey, man, this society's falling apart. We need people out there, man. We need, you know, that kind of thing, you know.
So what was the play and what was the role that you got after this?
The play was Anton Chekhov's The Boar. It was a one-act play, and I played Grigory Stepanovich Smirnov.
Gee, so you went from impersonating a yippie to playing Chekhov.
To playing Chekhov that evening.
Not the usual career arc.
Well, that's what I was telling you earlier. I do all kinds of things. I believe I'm very versatile in what I do.
My guest is James Belushi. He stars in the ABC cyber thriller Wild Palms. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Actor James Belushi is my guest. He started his acting career at Second City in Chicago. Now, were there characters that you created when you were with Second City that you would do over?
Well, you know, at Second City, there's two kinds of actors there. One is like what John did. John created a lot of different characters. They spoke differently. They wore different costumes. He did impressions. And I developed more of a persona for myself there. Most of my characters had slightly different variations opposed to complete different characters and
mm-hmm.
different voices. Although I did that too, but that wasn't the main thing.
So what was the persona you developed for yourself?
I'm still trying to find out.
Were you self-conscious at all at being in Second City after your brother had been there?
A little bit.
I mean, is there the set of expectations that you're going to be, like, similar to him, or that, you know, you have to strive to be different?
I wish I could have been similar to him. He was very good. No, I don't think it's any different than any other brother or brother-father or brother-brother situation. You know? You have role models, and you try to achieve to their standards.
Mm-hmm. Now, like several other people who ended up in Second City, you moved eventually to Saturday Night Live. How did you like having people writing sketches for you on Saturday Night Live?
It was difficult for me to get them to write sketches for me. The first year wasn't, the second year was.
What was difficult the first year?
It wasn't difficult the first year.
Oh, what was difficult the second year?
The second year, we had a new cast. Billy Crystal, Christopher Guest, Marty Short, Rich Hall. And they started writing for them. And so I kind of got left out a little bit.
Mm-hmm. That Saturday Night Live book, you know, the backstage of Saturday Night Live book says you had a real temper and that you didn't understand office politics.
Right. Okay. So?
True, okay.
What's the problem?
What of the sketches?
I was such an aggressive man.
Were you?
Yes.
Have you changed?
No, my aggression is not as raw.
Uh-huh.
It's much more skilled now.
Right. One of the sketches you were in that I really loved was the white guys rapping "We're White Guys."
Oh, that's a great piece, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Can you tell us about putting that one together?
Oh, a friend of mine, Chris Barnes, took me to a movie to see Wild Style.
Oh, that was one of the first rap films.
That was it.
Yeah.
And that was a rap, graffiti, and breakdancing film.
Uh-huh.
And we came out of there. He said, "You got to see this, you got to see this." We came out of there, and we fell right into the rhythm, and we started singing on the street. And so I said, "Let's write this for Saturday Night Live." And he wrote the song. And I sang it. And then another friend of mine, Rob Riley, helped me write the song called "White Guys Rap." Rob Riley was a Second City actor, writer.
If I remember correctly, you were wearing, like, plaid pants.
Plaid pants, yeah. A sweater, cardigan sweater, glasses. I'm a white guy, and I take no crap when I deliver my white rap. Now, you wonder how a man can stand to be uptight, polite, and white like me. Well, you know it runs in the family, just like the folks on Dynasty. I got my money the old-fashioned way. My granddaddy dropped dead one day. I'm rich. Hot damn. I never had to go to Vietnam. So I asked my girl to be my wife. She's pert and perky, this white guy's wife. Oh, that's white guy wife. That's not white guy rap.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, yeah.
That's wonderful.
She would sing, "I pick him up at the railway station, grit my teeth in pure frustration, meet my friends at the tennis club, get a pedicure and a body rub. We all go shopping. I buy a dress, put it on the white guy's American Express, Visa, Diner, MasterCard, an Oriole gentleman to mow the yard.
Oh, that's
on
great.
Weekends, for a special thrill, we fire up the Weber grill. We all go over to someone's house and drink within an inch of our lives." Oh, I can't remember the rest. And she would sing, "I'm liberated. I belong to now, but I voted for Reagan anyhow." He's a white guy, and his budget cuts will hurt other people, but they won't hurt us. We're extremely white. All right, we walk with our buttocks extremely tight. Yeah, it was fun stuff.
Any other sketches that stand out in your mind as favorites?
Well, I did a lot of short film pieces on Saturday Night Live. Those are my most successful pieces.
Uh-huh.
Because of what we were talking about earlier is the persona I had. I transferred the film more than it did to that stage at Saturday Night Live. You had to be, the things that were really successful on Saturday Night Live were very big characters.
Right.
And I could never commit to them. And so I was much more in, I don't know.
Well, but that's interesting because a lot of the Saturday Night Live alums haven't really made it in films. Do you know what I mean? Whereas you're establishing a really successful film career.
Well, film is...
I mean, maybe you really are more of the film actor than the TV sketch comic guy.
Yeah, I'm better in film than I was in Saturday Night Live, I think, yeah. It was hard for me to commit to those big characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like Piscopo was great on the show. He created these great wild characters with prosthetics, and on film he has to be himself, which is more difficult to do. But like I did at Second City, is I developed myself more on stage than these caricatures to hide behind.
Mm-hmm. Which was your first film?
Thief, James Caan, Michael Mann directed.
Yeah, that was good. You were good in that.
Yeah, it was a great film.
What's some of the best advice you were given by a director about how to carry yourself on film?
Well, Chris Kane, the guy who directed The Principal, he would... I'd get up in the morning at 6 o'clock or 5:30, and I'd do my exercises. I'd run. I'd eat properly. I'd shower. I came to the set prepared, blood running red, ready to go. And he would shoot these scenes where I'd have to walk down the hall, cut, walk down this hall, cut, or scenes in Masters, which you don't really act as hard in. And then we'd have lunch, and we'd eat, and you get a little tired, and you have to kind of have coffee to get up again. And we'd shoot another couple hours. And then at 4:30, 5 o'clock, he would shoot my close-ups. And, you know, after the third day, I got rancid with him, you know. What are you doing? Why do you wait to the end of the day to shoot these close-ups? I'm exhausted. I can shoot them in the morning when I'm fresh. I'm ready to go. I'm hot. But why do you wait till 5 o'clock? He goes, well, at 5 o'clock, you're tired and you stop acting.
Oh.
So he would beat me up all day so where I couldn't control my craft. And what he would end up getting is the real me.
Huh.
And that's when he'd shoot the close-ups. So what I learned from him was that not to think so hard, not to work so hard.
After your brother died, there was a lot of press coverage about it, including the book Wired by Bob Woodward.
Right.
I wonder what it was like for you to read a lot about your brother, some of which you probably thought was true and some of which you probably thought was untrue.
Well, let me put it this way. I read Wired by Bob Woodward, and after I read that book, I put it down and I thought two things. One is that Nixon is innocent. Two, that his third source was Roger Rabbit. I believe Bob Woodward, in my opinion, is a fraud, and his time will come. He's a rumor mill. He's a step below a gossip columnist who juxtaposes rumors and makes up a third source to confirm it. He's a rumor mill. He's a slime bag. What can I tell you?
What are the ground rules you've come up with for yourself in terms of what's personal and what's public when you're interviewed?
I don't know. It depends on the question. I don't know.
Right, right. Okay.
You know, I don't talk about certain things.
Right.
I don't talk about a lot of things.
Right. What's coming up for you after Wild Palms?
After Wild Palms? Hopefully, I'm producing a film called Cops, which was taken from a stage play in Chicago, with Danny Aykroyd and myself. A very serious, edgy piece about the Chicago police.
James Belushi. He stars in the miniseries Wild Palms. It premieres Sunday evening on ABC. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, The Gospel According to Wilton Barnhart. Barnhart is the author of the new novel, Gospel, an 800-page saga about the search for the lost gospel of the 13th disciple. We'll talk about the Bible, the millennium, and Barnhart's own search for answers. And world music critic Milo Miles reviews the debut album by the women's a cappella group Zap Mama, featuring songs from Zaire, Syria, South Africa, and Cuba. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton took his economic plan on the road again today. Mr. Clinton presented a new program intended to convince the American public that his plan will achieve all the deficit reductions that he has proposed. In New York, NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
In a speech at the Cooper Union School for Science and Art in New York City this afternoon, the president proposed to create a new deficit reduction trust fund. He would take all the money from his tax revenues and entitlement savings and, in effect, lock them up, passing a new law requiring that all that money go to deficit reduction. None of it could go to new spending programs. The plan is designed to satisfy the concerns of Democratic lawmakers, leery of voting for the president's new tax hikes, and their constituents, who are willing to pay more taxes, but only if the money is spent on solving the deficit problem. The president's trust fund program wouldn't change anything in his tax and spending plans. It would merely add another budget enforcement law to rules that already require all new tax increases go toward deficit reduction or be balanced with offsetting tax cuts. In New York, I'm Mara Liasson.
In Moscow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin has called a national convention to complete work on changing the nation's laws. Yeltsin has set a deadline of June 10th in a bid to strengthen presidential powers and move to a free market economy. A competing draft is being prepared by opposition parliament members who want to keep a balance of power. Both sides accuse each other of lacking the authority to replace the nation's 1977 constitution. But Yeltsin gained ground with a recent vote of confidence in his leadership and approval of his economic reforms. In Germany, industrial workers in three states in the eastern part of the nation have overwhelmingly voted to go on strike. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Officials of the Steel and Metal Workers Union, IG Metall, say the necessary 75% approval rate for a strike was reached in all three states where a vote was taken. Union officials say workers in these regions will probably join a nine-day-old strike in two other eastern German states. This could mean the shutdown of most factories in eastern Germany producing steel, metal, and electronic products. The labor dispute erupted after employers canceled a scheduled 26% wage hike, part of a 1991 agreement between industry and labor to raise the lower East German wages to West German levels. Meanwhile, in the western part of Germany, tens of thousands of workers staged short warning strikes and demonstrations as a sign of support for striking Eastern German workers. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Bergen, Frankfurt.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 13 points to close at a new high of 3,482.31 on volume of 255 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. In the wake of a fire at a doll factory this week that killed 240 people, officials in Thailand say the country needs to take dangerous working conditions much more seriously. Women make up about 80% of the nation's workforce, and while most are paid $5 a day, some make less. Police say the fire occurred in a factory near the capital that was built of substandard materials, had few fire escapes, and no basic safety procedures. According to a labor expert, the government of Thailand has only 50 safety inspectors to enforce fire rules at 90,000 factories and businesses. A new study published today shows that older people who take a simple medical test each year are much less likely to die from colon cancer that kills 57,000 Americans every year. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
Only lung cancer kills more Americans than cancer of the colon and rectum. Doctors know that people who are diagnosed early on with these cancers are much more likely to get life-saving surgery. A widely used test to look for blood in the stool can provide early warning of colon cancer. And a study in today's New England Journal of Medicine shows a 33% reduction in colon cancer death among people over the age of 50 who took that test every year. Researchers caution that the test gives a lot of false alarms. Only one person in 10 with blood in the stool actually has colon cancer, and the more elaborate tests required to diagnose cancer are expensive. But the study shows that testing for blood in the stool annually can still save a lot of lives. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher says that there has been considerable progress made in efforts to bring back democracy to Haiti. After a meeting in New York with U.N. Secretary General Boutros-Ghali, Christopher said that there are plans now underway for restoring democracy to Haiti. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The new novel, Gospel, is an 800-page religious saga that is both satirical and scholarly. It's about a graduate student and a professor who travel around the world in search of the lost gospel of the 13th disciple of Christ. In telling their quest, author Wilton Barnhart tells his own version of the history of religion. He's described the book as a reverent but irreverent look at all the ways religion has unfolded itself over time. Controversial because it packs in every absurdity, every folly from Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Barnhart says all his historical references are true. Of course, the part he had to completely make up is the text of the Lost Gospel of Matthias, which is interspersed with the story. I wanted to know what gave Barnhart the idea of creating an undiscovered gospel.
There are a number of gospels that have been discovered this century, at the Nag Hammadi digs in 1948, and of course the Dead Sea Scrolls, which precede Christ. 1896, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene was turned up. In 1956, a Gospel of Mark, older than any copy that had ever existed, was found in the Mar Saba Monastery when they were doing some housekeeping. I believe that we will run across a first century gospel in the next few decades, and I wanted to pose that question. When we do actually hear something from the first century, how different will it be from what's in the Bible? Will it upset the fundamental beliefs of Christianity?
What did you want the gospel that you've written for this novel to reveal or to contradict?
I wanted the gospel that I include every other chapter in this book to be an embodiment, really, of everything that went wrong in the first century in the church. My gospel writer is the disciple Matthias. He is the 13th disciple. He's mentioned once and only once in the Bible. He is the trivia question of the disciples. He is the replacement for Judas. And consequently, I don't think he got in on any of the good miracles. I think he was sort of a tag-along. So his view is different from everyone else, and he's terribly concerned with his rank. He's terribly concerned with celibacy. He's very much like Paul and very much like Jerome. He's obsessed with everyone's sex life, and he very much wants to repress women in leadership roles in the church. So I made him the embodiment of all the wrong turns and all the follies of the early church.
Why did you want to make him the embodiment of everything that you felt went wrong with the church?
Because I think, really, in the 21st century, and it's starting now, I mean, this is hardly revolutionary, but a number of theologians, feminist and otherwise, feel like the church has gotten on the wrong track. The biggest arguments at the moment in the modern Catholic Church are, well, should we have celibate priests? Well, it's not scripturally based, this, and it's not even particularly traditional, because there were certainly, all the disciples were married. It says so in the Bible. Should there be women priests? Well, there were women in leadership roles. In fact, really, a study of the early church calls up the big question, should there be a priest at all? Maybe there should just be sort of a commune of charity with elders and deacons. That's the only early Christian community we can actually for sure say existed from the Bible. So I think all of this is going to be debated, and I sort of want to throw this book into the debate.
Now, as part of your research for your novel Gospel, you traveled around the world. Going in search of what?
I was going in search of a plot, actually. What I did was I tried to make the travels that my modern characters who are searching for this gospel traveled. They go from England to Ireland to Italy to Greece to Jerusalem, up the Nile from Egypt to Sudan to Ethiopia. All along the way, they get a tour of the Judeo-Christian and Islamic world. and they see all the strange things. Well, I wanted to do that travel too. I stayed in monasteries and pretended to be a pilgrim along the way, and I wanted to see what all the different varieties of faith were. I thought perhaps at the end of this search that I might actually arrive at an answer, but instead I've become very much a polytheist. I believe we all have a little piece of the truth. I do believe in God, and I always take great pains to say this is not an atheistic book. It is not an anti-God book, but it is very anti-religious. If you follow my distinction between spirituality and religion, it is quite nasty to organized religion. And at the end of it, I was left with a sense that everybody thinks they're 100% correct, and everybody thinks everyone else is going to hell. And I'm hoping that the reader will close my book, perhaps at the end, with a renewed sense of ecumenical spirit and tolerance for all the different varieties of belief.
Did you feel a little dishonest pretending to be a pilgrim in that kind of context?
Well, no, I am a pilgrim. I was open-minded to it all. I was ready to hear voices, and in fact, I had a very interesting set of traveling companions. I kept wearing them out. I was on the road for 9 months, and another one would fly in, and they would get worn out, and I would put them on the plane, broken and exhausted, and then another one would come in. I was with a Catholic woman and an Anglican friend that I had met at Oxford, and we were doing the monasteries of Egypt, and I was dragging them because they wanted to go see pyramids and things like that. And we went into the cave of the Pope of Alexandria. The Pope, unlike the Vatican's Pope, lives quite simply and lives in a cave two nights out of the week. And we were warned by the guest master who took us down this desert trail that it was, and it was nighttime for this, that it was a very holy place and that we would feel the Holy Spirit. Well, all three of us, stepping inside this cave, were suddenly overwhelmed with this sense of ecstasy. It spread throughout every part of our body, and I guess it's shown on our face because by this one flickering candle, the monk turned and said, "Ah, she is here. The Holy Spirit is with us." And my friend from Oxford, who was quite an atheist, was absolutely terrified and ran from the cave. But I'm willing to believe it's all true. I'm willing to believe that the Holy Spirit visited us that night.
What did you see in there?
Well, it was very simple. The Pope had an icon, a very holy icon, and there was a little carpet for himself, and then there was the candle, and that was the extent of his accommodation in there. So I figure he must be quite a holy man indeed. I almost got a chance to meet the Pope of Alexandria. It didn't quite work out, but I did talk to his assistant, or one of his right-hand men, who said that the Antichrist is among us and has been born in America. So I felt a little apologetic, but as you know, throughout the book, I harp on the end times. I mean, with 1999 and the turn of the millennium coming up, I really have some fun with this. Almost every Christian tradition and a number of the Jewish ones believe that the end is near.
Well, what were some of the manifestations you saw of awaiting the millennium?
Well, on Athos, they're very convinced that it's any day now, and I guess they're some of them are arming themselves, figuring that there will be a. It's a little tricky to talk about it because every tradition has a different view on it. The Irish monks at the moment believe the prophecies of Saint Malachi would suggest that with global warming that the world is ending. As the waters rise, that's supposed to be the sign. And the prophecies of Columbkilla, the same way. There's only supposed to be two more popes before the end of the world. So I guess they better get working on it down in the Vatican. And the Egyptians are fairly sure an all-out war with the Muslims is brewing, where the Christian and the Muslim worlds will fight. And it's all very bloody and horrifying what people are predicting. If you go to a place called Dionysiou, which is a monastery on the coast of Mount Athos, you can see frescoes painted in the 1500s that depict the end of the world. I mentioned them in my book. You see mushroom clouds and giant atomic blasts and missiles toppling cities of skyscrapers. And you think, my God, the 1500s, how could this vision have been so clear? And you also have cockroaches and scorpions that are wearing crowns, as if somehow the artist knew that these alone would be able to survive a nuclear blast. Very terrifying.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wilton Barnhart, and he's written a new novel called Gospel. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Novelist Wilton Barnhart is my guest. You write about martyrdom in your novel Gospel, and for instance, you say Lucy is the graduate student who's on this search for
That's
the gospel.
Right. Yeah.
She was taught that back in Roman days, a girl given the choice of either losing her virginity with some good-looking Roman prince or dying through unspeakable torture would take the unspeakable torture.
Yes, this was the message that the Roman Catholic tradition, well, it was before the Protestants separated. This was what the Christian tradition was, and this was the message to women. Mary becomes this, the amazing sort of submissive humiliation of Mary. Mary is rebuked. Mary says, no, I'm not worthy. All the female role models in the church were this kind of repressed woman who would do as the man would tell her. The message of the church for women has not been very positive, which is unfortunate because Jesus took women into his ministry. And Jesus as he says of Mary, Lazarus' sister, she has taken the better portion. It shall not be taken from her when she sat with the men to listen to the lesson. So I don't believe there is very much that Jesus would approve of the church's treatment of women through the years. And this elaborate sort of Mediterranean legends where the only thing a woman could do to pull equal with men was to die, was to die in unspeakable martyrdoms. I have lots of wonderful gore in the book for those who this is the kind of thing people don't believe, but the ascetic women, the convents of Egypt, where they would take a dull blade and split open their skin and introduce maggots into the wound so they would know what a foretaste of death was like. This was true mortification. I mean, this kind of stuff was practiced along with the castration cults and crucifixion cults and people who would stop strangers on the street and begged to be killed by them. I mean, just incredible, strange things in Christian history.
Your new book is Gospel. You've been on the road on a book tour for the past few weeks.
And past few months.
Okay. Now, while you've been on this tour, the Waco story came to an end. The story of the compound anyways.
Yeah, exactly.
Came to its climax. How did that fit into your story? I mean, here you are following not only the history of Christianity, but the history of cults based on Christianity.
Christianity has always had a propensity for the cult, for the extreme. When you think about this country particularly, we were founded, if you really are serious about it, we were founded very much by cultists. The people who lost the Civil War in England, the Puritans who had broken off with the church, the Congregationalists, later the Methodists, later the Amish, later the Moravians, these early groups were considered in many cases heretical, in many cases unsettling, and were persecuted. They're persecuted for the reasons that all sort of different movements are persecuted. And the Mormons, I mean, there's an example of a cult that has continued and has flourished in Utah. Although, it didn't help Joseph Smith, who was lynched, the founder of the cult. He claimed special revelation, like Koresh claimed special revelation. It's not possible. Wherever there is Christianity, there are these cults. Many times, they're within the context of the organized church. If you go down to Calabria, you see the flagellation festival, where the people beat themselves bloody in the street. I suspect there's some pagan origin to this that precedes Christianity, but the church decides to sort of turn a blind eye and say, well, as long as this is done in the name of the church, this is all right. I live in New Orleans where we have Mardi Gras. Now, there could not be a more irreligious, pagan bacchanal, celebrated. Maybe Rio, and their carnival is the same way. But the church calls it a holy festival, and therefore it precedes Ash Wednesday, after all, and it is sort of incorporated into the church. But all of these things are evidence of sort of a cultish, pagan underpinning. I've always felt that the United States is particularly ripe for cults. And the reason I feel that way is we don't have a very deep or very ancient culture. If you're born in a place like Naples, where your dialect of Italian is Neapolitan, where your food is Neapolitan, where the tradition of opera, the tradition of dress, everything about your life is so much that, you would never look up like an American could look up and say, I don't know who I am. I don't know what I believe. I don't know who I really am inside. But you could in this country because of the way we move about, because of the fact that we're a fairly modern, progressive, Northern European-based country. And I think people are lost, and I think people have these spiritual searches.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Wilton Barnhart is the author of the new novel, Gospel. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear about President Clinton's talk today, in which he said that he will raise taxes only to reduce the deficit, that is, not to fund any new programs. Also, more on why the Republicans were unable to block the motor voter registration bill. We'll be hearing about Reconstruction and the lawmakers whom blacks in the South elected after the Civil War, what was really true about them as opposed to what we've learned all these years. We'll be hearing about what Slobodan Milosevic is likely to be doing over the next couple of weeks if the Bosnian Serbs vote against the Vanzoen peace plan, and Joseph Brodsky's campaign to make poetry available all over the country.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. World music commentator Milo Miles has been hearing voices, rhythmic and harmonizing a cappella voices, that is, and he'd like you to listen too.
Singer Marie Dalna was born in Zaire but lives in Paris. Like many such dual nationals, she has come up with an eclectic blend of musics, though with an earthy twist all her own. Instead of taking inspiration from the throbbing urban styles of Zaire, Dalna has drawn on the secretive Mbutu pygmies and the haunting chants of their very ancient culture. She even lived with them for a time. With forgivable romanticizing, she seems to regard the Pygmies as pure people, free of the corruption of the infamous modern world. And so Dalna and the four other women in the group Zap Mama go for the primordial purity of unaccompanied voices. Well, with a few dabs of percussion here and there. Obviously, the group doesn't stick with just pygmy traditions on its debut album, called Just Zap Mama. Dalna shows an omnivorous imagination in applying a cappella to songs from Syria, South Africa, Cuba, and Spain, as well as original songs like Bottom.
The boat goes to the bottom, to the bottom. The boat goes to the bottom, and people don't care, standing in the middle of the boat goes to the bottom, mm-hmm. To the bottom, mm-hmm. The boat goes to the bottom, and nobody reacts, the captain shouts, clear our deck, we sing like a stone, but you don't care, standing in the middle of the boat goes to the bottom, to the bottom. The boat goes to the bottom.
Yeah.
The boat goes to the bottom. To the bottom. The boat goes to the bottom. And nobody reacts, the captain shouts, put on your life jacket, you sing by the bow. But you don't care, standing in the middle of the boat goes to the bottom.
And Zap Mama casually ranges from doo-wop-like effects with sweet harmonies and snappy chord changes to almost purely percussive passages that combine African folk, hip-hop, and Bobby McFerrin-type scat.
I say sue, 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 I say sue.
Zap Mama rigorously avoid big displays of virtuosity and relish their humorous bits. At its best, this approach sets up a private party spontaneity. At worst, though, it makes for an uneasy blend of the silly and the solemn. On the Zap Mama album, it's a bit of a jolt to go from an anti-apartheid anthem to a joke number imitating a balky car engine. But this quintet has more fluent programs within them, and already any fans of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, Sweet Honey in the Rock, or the street corner serenades of American a cappella pop should come to Zap Mama warmly.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge. Zap Mama's album is on the Luwakabop label. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Stem, toi coucou, toi coucou, stem, 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 toi coucou, toi coucou. Stem, toi coucou, toi coucou, stem, 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 toi coucou, toi coucou.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the man who revolutionized cinematography. We talk with Garrett Brown, the inventor of the Steadicam, the Skycam, and the MobiCam. You can see his own cinematography in Rocky, The Shining, and Return of the Jedi. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.